This is the Business of College Sports podcast with your host, the founder of businessofcollegesports.com, Christy Dosh. Find her on Twitter and Instagram at sports biz myths.
Welcome to the Business of College Sports podcast. I'm your host, Christy Dosh, the sports biz miss, and I'm really looking forward to bringing you today's episode. I was able to record this about a month ago with two very experienced immigration attorneys who are doing incredible work on behalf of international student athletes who want to take advantage of name, image, and likeness. We've got two different attorneys today who have done some work together and also separately, Ksenia Myarova and Amy Maldonado. They did this session for a group I run called the NIL Collectives Consortium, where collectives get education and share best practices with each other. And they agreed to allow this session to be recorded so that I could share it here on the podcast with everyone else. I know I learned some new things during this episode, and it really makes me optimistic about opportunities being available for international student athletes. So without further ado, I give you this interview with Ksenia Myarova and Amy Maldonado. Amy, Ksenia, welcome to the Business of College Sports podcast. Thank you both for making time to be here.
Thank you for having us. It's such a pleasure.
I told you before you got on, it's so exciting to have two more female attorneys on here with me, so I'm not on here all by myself. And I was so excited to see the work that you all have been doing in this space. And our podcast listeners know that this is a topic we have visited at least twice before on the podcast around the ability of international student athletes to be able to monetize their name, image, and likeness. And I feel like since I had the first of those podcasts a year ago, we've actually seen some progress, and some of that has been from you two. So I'm excited to dig in on it with you a little bit more and the things that you've accomplished. But I thought it might be nice for the audience to start by explaining what a student visa is and sort of why we have a problem here to begin with, so that if somebody picks up this podcast and they haven't listened to my others, they'll understand why this is even a problem. So I would open it up to either one of you, or if both of you want to chime in on what a student visa is and what those restrictions are that became a problem with name, image, and likeness.
Sure. So I can take a stab at it, and Amy, if I miss anything, you can perhaps color in the blank spots. But essentially, a student visa is going to have very limited employment authorization opportunities. And the whole crux of the issue is that most of what we think of activities in the NIL space is going to be employment within the definition of immigration law. So we would need a student to be in work authorized status for them to be able to do work. Now, the work authorization that is available to a student athlete is very limited and typically tied to their program of study. So if you're studying, you know, microbiology, you may be able to get work authorization to go work in a lab and to test your skills there. And there are two options. Typically, there's a training that you can do while you're still in school, and then a postgraduate internship that you can do. And in certain circumstances, you can also get need-based emergency work authorization for on-campus employment, but that would be something like working at the library or at the cafeteria directly on campus. And so that none of these scenarios really cover doing work for an outside sponsor in the NIL context. So if Gatorade wants to sponsor an athlete to post on social media, to attend autograph signings, to otherwise promote the product, that would not be appropriate under any of these available options for employment authorization. Amy, did you want to add something else here?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. The only thing I would add to that is that there has not been a lot of good guidance from NCAA, from universities. Basically, there's been no guidance, including from the government. And it's pretty clear within the immigration legal community that we agree that NIL activities that are active instead of passive are employment under the definition of immigration law. And then the question became for us, how do you obtain employment authorization for NIL? And so that's kind of, Ksenia and I are friends, we're colleagues, we've been co-founded a Sports Immigration Lawyers Association that's just getting started to do impact litigation, where we talk on the phone like every other day, probably. So we were brainstorming this issue, and Cassidy has a lot of experience in the same types of visas I do, other than you do a lot of individual Olympic athlete type things that I mostly do league sports. So I do a lot of Major League Baseball. I represent four teams. I represent a bunch of Major League Baseball players. And then I do like equestrian, squash, tennis, soccer, but that's not primarily, I'm a baseball person. And so we just kind of brainstormed with the visas that we use for professional and amateur athletes as to how we could, you know, how we could find a workaround after we did things like lobbying and tried to get legislation passed with a group of other attorneys and people in the NIL space that were trying to get authorization for international student athletes to benefit from this.
Amy, this might be a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it in case anybody else has a similar question. What type of visa does a professional athlete have, and why couldn't a student athlete just get that one? I'm assuming it has to do with them being employees, but maybe I'm off base there.
So, yes, the athletes that I work with who are Major League Baseball players have P1A visas for professional athletes. The requirement is that they have a contract with a major league sports team. There are also, if you have a league sport where you have combined revenues of $10 million and at least six teams, so that includes some independent baseball associations, et cetera, then you can get those visas. The amateur athletes who are competing in the Olympics, et cetera, those visas are more kind of appropriate for the NIL space and college athletes. But we do sometimes use, and that's the P1. We also sometimes use the O1, which is an extraordinary ability athlete, for people who are at the very top of their field. And the examples that are always given are you won a Nobel Prize or an Academy Award. It's not quite that restrictive because you can satisfy three alternative criteria, but you really have to be extraordinary to get this visa. So most NCAA athletes would not fall into that classification.
I know that you got one, though, so I'm going to put a pin in that, and I want to talk about that one. But before we jump ahead to how you got one of those for a student athlete, Ksenia, when you were talking and you mentioned the types of work that are appropriate under that student visa around, you know, work that would be related to what the student athlete is majoring in, is there any, I'm trying to think creatively here, is there a creative solution where, say, a Gatorade could work with an international student athlete who was a marketing major and have them do a legit internship with Gatorade in marketing, but also be posting on their own social about that internship and getting paid to do that?
So I think that if they were just doing a Gatorade marketing internship, doing the same sort of stuff that any other marketing intern would do, I think that would be appropriate. For me, I get uncomfortable when we cross the line of what's normally done within the context of that internship, because, you know, fundamentally, this comes down to a spectrum of risk. I always talk about on every podcast that I'm on this issue is how much risk do you want to take in the absence of guidance, right? And you have to account for the fact that there are going to be different opinions and different positions on this. And there are things that are, you know, very clearly safe. There are things that are very clearly unsafe. And then there are things that fall somewhere in the, you know, in the spectrum in between. And for me, that's a scenario that I'm not comfortable with. Now, there may be other attorneys that would say, you know, if your DSO approves it, why not? I'm okay. But, you know, it's just fundamentally sort of a matter of opinion until there's concrete guidance and, you know, that says otherwise.
And that guidance does not appear to be coming in any reasonable time frame. So,
yeah. Yeah, they don't appear to be wanting to produce that guidance. And a DSO is a designated CVIS officer, which is going to be the person at the International Student Office at the university. It's going to be sort of responsible for maintaining the lifeline of the student athletes or regular students, international student status.
Thank you. Amy, you mentioned you don't think that that guidance is coming. Why do you think that we haven't gotten any guidance yet, and why it's taking so long and doesn't seem to be on the horizon?
So the NCAA initially came out with a statement that said international student athletes could benefit from this. And then they basically retracted it because there was no guidance from the government. And I think, you know, the issues around student athletes were raised to them. And so they backed off, and the government does nothing in a reasonable time period. So, for example, in my regular cases where I do employment-based visas for people in tech, we still have to do Sunday print ads because our regulations were written in the late 90s and they have not been updated. And so my tech clients laugh when I tell them we have to do a Sunday print newspaper ad for a tech, you know, a tech startup. And I'm just like, this, the wheels turn very slowly in immigration. And that's part of what we're talking about. I mean, it'll take years to get a regulation. If the government's even willing to do that and administrations change and, you know, who knows if that's going to be workable. It would be good to get something in the statute, but that's almost impossible in the political climate. And, you know, so Cassini and I are just trying to work with the law that we have because it's not very likely to change given how controversial literally any immigration related law about anything is right now. So
I wanted to touch on the idea of passive income that has come up on previous episodes I've done on this topic. And I believe the example that was used on a previous episode from another immigration attorney was that if a student athlete, an international student athlete, owned rental properties and was earning income off of those rental properties, that that might be considered passive. And we sort of took that a little bit farther and started talking about, okay, if it was, say, an NFT and a company licensed the use of the international student athlete's name, image, and likeness for the NFT, and that company did all the marketing and promotion for the NFT, and the student athlete did nothing, you know, would that pass muster as passive? And that particular attorney thought the answer was yes. But I've noticed that more and more people are trying to figure out what is passive, what might work in this circumstance. Do you all have any examples of things that you've seen that you feel comfortable fall under that idea of passive income that international student athletes could maybe take advantage of?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think like one very persistent myth that I see perpetuated in the NIL space is that group licensing deals are necessarily passive, and that's just not true. Every deal needs to be analyzed on its, you know, individual terms to determine what are the obligations of the individual athletes or the team athletes under that deal, right? And so I think the example that you gave, I would agree, to me sounds like passive income. Something, you know, similar in that regard would be like placing a pre-existing image of an athlete on a Tumblr or a t-shirt and selling that. I think the problem where you could possibly get into hot water is that if an athlete understands that there's a monetary stake in this for them, right? So that they're getting a percentage of the sales of that NFT or that Tumblr or that t-shirt, they are going to promote it. It's really, really difficult to convince, you know, a 20-year-old kid who sees the potential for earning the money not to do it. And I think that's the tricky part, is like really controlling the athlete and really making it clear that, you know, you literally, you can't go out to your friends and say, go buy this. You can't do any of that because that's potentially getting you into hot water. So that would be my comment. Sorry?
Yeah, I agree with you, of course. But you couldn't, you know, it gets very questionable because, for example, I've told my clients, if you have a U.S. work authorized social media manager, that person can post on your social media without any issues. However, you can't pose for that person in photos. You can't, you know, put on scripted content because then you're crossing that line. And there are specific in what's called the Foreign Affairs Manual, which is used by the State Department in adjudicating visas. There are specific activities that are permitted on a B1 business visitor visa, like signing contracts. That is clearly, if it's permitted on a B1, it's not work. So signing NIL contracts in the U.S., I don't have any problem with that whatsoever. But the line of when you're actively doing something is just, it's fuzzy. And, you know, again, Ksenia is right. I advise my clients very conservatively because no one has an entitlement to a visa. And there is something called the doctrine of consular non-reviewability. So if you get a State Department officer who thinks you worked without authorization and they don't want to renew your student visa, they don't have to. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can't file an appeal. You can't really sue. I mean, you can go to something called LegalNet in the State Department that will not help you. And you can try to go to a congressional office if the university really wants you and you're an important player. And that's about all you can do. So I try to be very conservative and make it clear that my clients are on the not, have not violated their status side of the line.
And I think on a related issue to that, I think one scenario that comes up quite a lot in these calls is, well, what about if the athlete is paid outside the U.S. or, you know, and I think that's very clear under U.S. immigration regulations that any services that are rendered in the U.S., regardless of whether they're paid for, not paid for, whether they're paid for inside the U.S. or outside the U.S., if you are rendering services in the U.S. that are typically subject to compensation, that is work, period. So I saw a scenario with a Tennessee basketball player who was apparently donating his NIL proceeds to some kind of charity. And that doesn't work either, because in order for him to donate the money, he has to have title to the money, right? And the moment he acquires title to the money, it's, you know, and if it's on the basis of him doing something, then we have a work authorization problem. So I don't like that scenario at all. I think similarly, there was a Kansas kicker that was doing, or a punter that was doing the same thing. So I don't like that scenario. I think you really have to zero in on services rendered. And like Amy said, there are certain situations where you may be able to get a stand-in, like a social media manager. But the risk of that is, again, if you're going in front of a consular officer, how are you going to prove to that consular officer who pressed the button on the post? It's on your social media, right? I have a contract with a social media manager. Okay, but how do I know you didn't press that button, right? How do you prove that?
What about the, we've seen these out of the U.S. tournaments happening, and people think as soon as they get student athletes off U.S. soil, then everything is fair game. Is that true?
Well, from a U.S. immigration perspective, it comes out of, you know, sort of the purview of our regulatory system. But just because you're not within the, you know, the U.S. immigration system doesn't mean you can work without authorization in the Bahamas or wherever it is that they're filming, right? Like, they have their own immigration laws. They have their own employment authorization requirements. You can't just assume that just because you're admitted to go there on vacation, you can do things that are revenue generating activities.
So I actually looked this up before I took my daughter, who's 18, to France this summer. And France actually allows you to work remotely for up to a brief period of time. I think it's 90 days. I don't remember now. But you actually need to look at the laws of every country you go to if you're going to do that, to see if you're violating your status. Or if you don't, you know, some countries are a lot more lackadaisical than others. I was surprised that Europe does not seem to have the same kinds of restrictions that we have on working temporarily.
Another situation I've seen recently, and I swear I won't throw at you every situation I've seen, but I just recalled one as we were talking about this. I know there was a collective that put up billboards in Canada for some of their Canadian student athletes and compensated them for the use of their image in those billboards. How do we feel about that?
They were Canadian citizens, so I actually looked at that and I have no issue with that.
Okay. Because the question I'm getting from a lot of the collectives that I've worked with is, can we just take our international student athletes out of the country and do something with them and make it work? So it sounds to me like if you're trying to do that, the safest thing is taking them to their home country.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense
to me. Or you have to invest the time and money to look at every country that you travel to. So, unless you don't care if you ever get back into the Bahamas or wherever you're going.
Well, here's one I got from a collective, because I told some of the collectives I work with they could send me in questions. And this is one of the questions I got. They said that they have a They have two international student athletes on their team from different countries. They want to know if they can take, if the student athlete can go to their local consulate or embassy and perform the sponsored posts and be compensated while they're at the consulate or the embassy versus actually being home in their country.
So that's really interesting because, I mean, the territory of the embassy is not considered to be the territory of the U.S., right? So I think the, strictly speaking, you know, by the black letter of the law, that would be outside the purview of the reach of U.S. immigration law. But again, we have to look at, you know, the consular officer because it's the enforcement. You have to understand the enforcement mechanism, right? It's how do these things come up and in what context and what can you do about it? And so if you have a student athlete who's going and posting things from their embassy, provided that, you know, they've negotiated that with their embassy, but they go to their consular interview to renew their F1 visa or maybe to change to a P1 or an O1, and the consular officer doesn't like it because they don't understand that, you know, the embassy is not the territory of the United States, then they can, in their discretion, deny the visa and you have no appellate options. So, I mean, I think that one thing that really bears repeating is that consular officers, you have to understand how the consular corps is set up, right? Consular officers are people who have signed up for the Foreign Service, and every person who wants to be in the Foreign Service has to do a stint at a consulate. So these are not necessarily destination jobs for them. These are not people who are passionate about being at a consulate. They're given a two-week crash course, and they're like, go adjudicate some visas. And the average time at the window is like 90 seconds. And this is a conveyor belt situation. They don't have time to pursue the nuance, to really figure out, you know, whether something is legal or not, to look at the law at all. A lot of times, as our colleague Chris Richardson, who's an immigration attorney, a former consular officer, former NIV visa chief, has presented at multiple conferences, a lot of times it's just a gut reaction. They like it or they don't like it, and they issue and or don't issue the visa based on that. So again, I think, you know, in light of that, the more sort of the more you get towards areas where things you have to, like, you know, back it up with complicated legal arguments, the more likely you are to get in trouble at the 90-second visa interview with no appellate opportunity.
Yeah.
That's really helpful. Thanks for explaining that.
I have a lot of consular locations. They put up signs that said, when in doubt, 214B, which is a grounds for denial just based on we think you have the wrong intent. We don't think you necessarily qualify, but it's almost impossible to overcome 214B denials. It's very difficult. So their tendency, if they have any doubts about an approvability, is to deny.
And am I remembering correctly? I feel like I spoke to another immigration attorney. I can't remember if it was here on the podcast or for a story I was writing. And that if a student athlete were to lose their student visa and later wanted to come back to play professional sports here in the U.S., that the loss of that student visa could make it more complicated to get the visa to come back as a pro athlete. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. Any ground of inadmissibility, any finding of ineligibility or inconsistent intent and activity, you know, that is outside of what the authorized status permits, is going to be a problem for future visa applications. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it also depends on what the grounds for denial are. So if they find that you make a misrepresentation in your interview, that's a permanent ground of inadmissibility. You have very serious problems forever. If they think you worked without authorization and you're coming back with a work visa, if you can convince them that your work will be limited to the authorization that's carried by the visa, because these visas are generally either filed by agents or employers. And so what you're doing has to fall within the scope of the visa. And if you've previously violated the scope of your visa by working outside it, they may not believe that you're not going to do it again. And like I said, no one has a right to be a temporary visitor to the United States. So...
Oh, yeah, I'm risk adverse as an attorney, as you two both probably are as well. I know not every attorney shares that, but I would err on the more conservative side as well, especially when you're talking about the impact it can have on your future for years to come or for the rest of your working years. So I thought I remembered somebody telling me that and just wanted to clear that up. So we talked, you guys have mentioned at various points, the P1 visa, the O1 visa, there are these other types. Can you tell me a little bit about what the other potential options are for student athletes other than being on a student visa? And then I'd love to dig into some of the success you all have seen in getting these.
Sure. So basically, and this is, Cassandra and I have had many, many conversations over a long period of time about how to work around this stuff. And I do a lot of O1 visas. And like I said, my P1s are usually just based on having a major league contract, and they're pretty straightforward. And most of the teams file them themselves. So I don't even do that many Ps. But O1s and P's are listed on the CBP or ICE website as visa classifications that you can have while attending college. And there's a wrinkle to that that I'll let Ksenia address. But we were looking at it in terms of, okay, are you, you know, for somebody who's very extraordinary at the top of their field, you know, in terms of college athletics, can we do an extraordinary ability visa petition? For the P1, the individual P1 requires an athlete who's performing at an internationally recognized level of competition. And there's some language in the USCIS policy manual that would support basically finding that NCAA is that kind of level of competition based on, you know, viewership and dollars and a lot of different factors. And so looking at that, we thought, okay, we can try to use these to encompass the college athletics program plus school for these student athletes. It's a little bit tricky because the attendance of school is basically incidental to the purpose of the visa. And so what is the purpose of a student athlete? Is it to play college sports or is it to attend college? And that's kind of the issue that comes up. But, you know, I think there's a very strong argument to be made that it's really to play sports.
So the O1, I know that you have been able to get one of those for Hansel and Manuel. I believe that's the first. It's really the only one I was able to find. And that's how I found you all as well. I think Ksenia and I had been connected on Twitter for a little while anyway. But that's what made me want to invite you to come on, because I thought, okay, we need to revisit this topic because things have changed since I had attorneys on to talk about this last year. What do you have to show to get that, whether you want to talk about that specifically in his case or just what you think it takes to be able to get that for a student athlete?
So I was very happy with Hansel's case because Hansel and his petitioner, who's his sports agent, both authorized me to talk about this publicly and disclose details about the petition, which otherwise I would not be able to do because of attorney-client confidentiality. So, but I have explicit written permission from both of them to talk about this. So Hansel is really unique. And as a lot of people know, Hansel is a basketball player. He is basically a freshman in an NCAA Division I program. And he is really well known because he's just an extraordinary athlete, despite having one of his arms amputated after an accident when he was a child. And so there are these great videos of him, you know, doing slam dunks and all this crazy stuff. And the irony of Hansel's case is we could not go for a lower level because he's a freshman. He was never playing at an internationally recognized level of performance. So we couldn't try to get the visa that would really be applicable to most college athletes. The only option we had was to argue that he is really extraordinary. And so, like I said, you have to show that the person has won a major award or that they are... they can show three alternative evidentiary criteria. And the criteria we showed for Hansel were major media coverage, awards, original contributions to the sport, and high salary. And we used actually the On3 valuation of his NIL value to show high salary. And we got, I mean, it was a nightmare. We had such pushback from USCIS. They did not like this petition. And they, you know, they wanted to reject media coverage. And I'm just like, this kid has an ESPN.com documentary about him. Like, come on. Yeah. But this is the thing, like, and Ksenia can tell you about this also, because these regulations were written decades ago, they will not accept newspaper articles that don't have the author's name on them. So any Associated Press article, not going to work for you. Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And so they basically did not believe in the valuation. They said it was speculative. They rejected media coverage. They rejected his awards because they said that, you know, he received a lot of notoriety in the Dominican Republic where he's from for basically just being really exceptional. And they had a parade for him and gave him some award. And they said, well, he just got this award for being Dominican. And so in our response to the request for evidence, we said it specifically said for his contributions to the sport of basketball. Like, it says this in his award. So part of the issue that we deal with as attorneys is the Immigration Service is just, it's probably worse now than I've ever seen it since I started practicing in 1998. I mean, Ksenia has a case of a similar visa for a coach where the government wanted to reject the fact that he coached his athlete to a world gold because he only got a gold in his own weight class. I'm just like, oh, yeah. I mean, it's insane what we have to deal with. And so I was very happy. We pushed back hard. We were able to show NIL deals approximating the valuation that were on the table for Hansel. And we pushed back really hard on all the criteria, and we got it through. And so, Ksenia had a lot of success with a similar case. It's not an O1A, but it's the EB1A immigrant visa, and I'll let you talk about that for the hammer thrower.
Amy, let me ask you one more thing before we move on. How long did it take from start to finish?
So we filed this case under premium processing, which is supposedly 15-day turnaround, but because we got such a brutal request for evidence, the whole process ended up taking about 6 months.
Okay.
Which is a long time. I mean, we definitely wanted that before he started college, and we got it, I guess, a month and a half ago or something, not very long ago. So, and this is his first semester. It's not terrible, but it took a lot longer than we wanted.
And Ksenia, she said you've got one that's an EB1. What kind of visa is that?
So to just kind of maybe go back a little bit and help our audience understand, I think that, you know, the entry level non-immigrant visa that we deal with in sports is the P1. And Amy mentioned that she does this primarily for league athletes, but there's also a pathway for individual athletes to get P1s. And our idea is to try to use these visas for NIL were born of my prior success getting O's and P's for college athletes long before NIL was announced, just for other reasons, based on their, you know, extraordinary achievements, primarily track and field athletes. And that's kind of, you know, whereas Amy's the baseball lady, I'm the track and field lady. So basically, that's the entry level. The next step up is going to be the O, which is a big step up because, you know, I like to tell my athletes that the O is really for athletes who have significant international renown, right? So typically we're looking for, in individual sports, we're looking for continental championship medals, a high world ranking, things like that to really get to that O1 caliber of performance. For the next level up, you're already talking about a green card, and this is the EB1A, and that's a permanent resident status. So if you're extraordinary enough to do this, then you know, you get to stay forever. So and it is possible, although, you know, certainly not very likely, and this is going to be limited to a very small number of highly accomplished athletes in the NCAA, but it is possible to get an EB1A as an NCAA athlete. So I was successful this year in getting an EB1A approved for two track and field athletes. They're actually both female, which I'm really happy about because the women usually get a harder time. And they're field athletes. They're not track athletes. So typically, you know, I have an easier time working with sprints because I think, like, people who don't understand the sport understand running fast. Everybody understands running fast, right? When you get into throws and jumps and various other things, it gets a little bit more complex. So I was able to get the green card for a hammer thrower this spring. And we started with her last November. So right after NIL was announced, we started with her, and she's super accomplished. She's the youngest Olympic finalist in the hammer in the history of the games. She actually won silver at the World Championship this past year. And I was really amazing, really accomplished, had a very high world ranking. And then I was reached out to by another athlete, another field athlete, another female thrower. And her case was a lot more borderline. And I really was like, oh, I don't know if we're going to be able to make this one, because her ranking was, not as high. And she only had one continental level finals, but no championship, no medals at a continental level game, and nothing at the world championship level. But we were able to kind of fashion it based on her significant accomplishments in the NCAA, as well as the fact that she's among the best of all time from her country. So we were kind of able to reference the fact that even though the country's not particularly strong in the throws, she was number two on the all-time list, and we were able to use that to establish sustained national acclaim. And I think that that was kind of what did it for her. So, so as Amy and I started strategizing this when NIL first broke, a little bit more than a year ago, we were thinking about these things. We were thinking about so what is sort of the level of accomplishment that is required? How many athletes in the NCAA do we think might qualify? And what are the sports that are sort of most conducive to being able to transition to these things? Because based on, a number of nuances that I don't think we have time to go into in the time limitation that we have with this podcast, certain sports are just not going to work. It's just going to be very, very difficult, right? But as Amy and I have kind of brainstormed over the months that we've been working on this, I think we've identified that in the individual sport side, the sports that are most conducive to NIL-based visas are track and field, swimming, and gymnastics. And on the team side, it's going to be baseball, football, and basketball.
Okay, that makes sense. That's it. That was going to be my next question, was what sort of, I was going to ask you to put a percent on what percent of international athletes do you think have a shot at this? But I think that's really helpful to hear that some sports are going to lend themselves to it more than others.
But you still have to be at the very top. And I would say, to answer that question, I would say less than 5% of athletes in the NCAA would qualify for any of this stuff.
Okay.
You think the P also?
Yeah. I mean, P's are just, they're fighting us back so much on the P's. It's the basketball piece, I think that we would we would have a pretty difficult time. So because of the internationally recognized level of performance, they're really harping on that right now. So, I think that issue is ripe for litigation. Some of that language is ultra virus, but that's a whole separate topic, I think, possibly for another podcast.
There's also the financial question, because I've been, since Hansel's case, I've been contacted by several NCAA athletes, and I just tell them, rule of thumb, and agents also, rule of thumb, if you don't have $10,000 worth of NIL on the table, it's probably not worth the legal fees and the visa fees. So, how many college athletes are going to have $10,000 worth of NIL on the table?
You must be clairvoyant, because that was going to be my next question, was if there's an agent or collective listening to this that wants to try and do this on behalf of one of their athletes, what's a ballpark number for legal fees to get something like this done?
It's really going to range. I don't think we are allowed to talk publicly about fees just due to antitrust law, but I think Amy is right with that rule of thumb. If there's not at least $10,000 on the table, it's not going to be worth it.
That makes sense. Well, I think there's a lot more I'd love to ask you, but I think that's what I've got for sort of what we can handle in one podcast episode. I know despite having already talked to an immigration attorney a couple of times on the podcast, I learned even more new things and happy to see that there has been some progress since I visited this last school year with another immigration attorney. So I'm hopeful that some of those additional applications that you ladies have out there are going to turn out positively for these athletes. And just wanted to thank you for coming and being on the podcast. I bet there's people who are going to want to get in touch with you. So I will put your contact information in the show notes, but maybe if you both want to give social media channels that you're active on or the best way to reach out to you. And I'll start with Ksenia.
Sports Visa Lawyer on Instagram has my link tree and you can book consultations on there.
And what about you, Amy?
I would just go to my website, amaldonatolaw.com. I always joke with my kids that I don't use the gram because I'm a grandma, basically, but I'm not actually a grandma, but I just don't. Yeah. Ksenia is helping me be more social media savvy, which I appreciate. And of course, I'm no longer on Twitter, which I was, but not anymore.
So, understandable. Yeah. Well, I will get that in the show notes. So if people want to reach out to you all, they know how to find you. Thank you both so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Christy.